In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about American energy policy and the way that it has, in recent years, become increasingly tangled with American foreign policy. Our guest for the program is Michael Clare, and we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in a recent book that he has authored titled Blood and Oil. The subtitle is The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Petroleum. Metropolitan Books is the publisher. In the preface to the book, Professor Clare makes reference to some of his earlier work where he was looking at the causes of conflict in the world. And he writes, after looking at a number of recent wars in Africa and in Asia, he came to the conclusion that resources and not differences in civilizations or identities were at the root of most contemporary conflict. And if you look at all of these resources, he also concludes that the most problematic is petroleum. He also writes that petroleum is unique among the world's resources, that it has more potential than any of the others to provoke major crises and conflicts in the years ahead. He makes the argument in the book that increasingly the United States has come to depend and will depend even more on imported oil to supply our energy needs. He says that our growing reliance on imported petroleum is also likely to translate into a recurring use of military force to protect our investments. And he makes the argument that if we don't change our energy policies, it is very likely in the future that we will clash with other world powers, China, perhaps other emerging powers, over access to the world's supplies of petroleum. A little bit more about our guest here, Michael Clare. He is Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies. It's a joint appointment that involves Amherst College, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith, and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Those are the five colleges. He's also director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies. He serves on the board of directors of the Arms Control Association, the National Council of the Federation of American Scientists, the advisory board of the Arms Division of Human Rights Watch. He's defense correspondent of The Nation, contributing editor of Current History, and also member of the editorial board of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And he's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means that if it would be long-distance call for you, you can use that number and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who are listening are certainly welcome to call with questions and comments. Professor Clare, hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
How is it that you got interested in approaching the idea of conflict or trying to understand conflict from the resource perspective and not from, you know, so much of the analysis of conflict and why it happens centers on ideology? Perhaps increasingly it seems to be about ethnicity. But you make the argument, and I think certainly there are other people who have made the argument, that really at the bottom line is a struggle over control of resources.
Well, you know, after the end of the Cold War, we all thought that the world was going to get a lot safer. You know, the Cold War was so intense and so destructive. We all thought, boy, this is over. The world is going to be a safer place, less war, less conflict. And it didn't turn out that way, as we so well know. The world has been even more bloody since the end of the Cold War as it was in the final decades before it. And so there's been a terrible struggle to try to explain why this is so. And certainly ethnicity and identity is one of the factors. But if you look closely at so many of the wars in Africa and Asia, you find at root there about diamonds, as in Angola and in Sierra Leone and Liberia. They're about timber, about gold mines, and I think increasingly about oil as well.
Well, there are a number of resources that are both strategic in their importance and finite in their supply. Is there something, do you think, about oil, however, that makes it stand out from all the others?
Absolutely. Oil is so special because it's so vital to the global economy and to the American economy. Oil supplies 40% of our energy in this country, more than any other source, and there's no substitute for it with our existing energy system. And it provides 97% of our transportation energy. But it's also, and this is what's special about oil, it's absolutely vital for the American military machine. The American war machine is the most highly mechanized on Earth. We're a global military power that has to send ships and planes everywhere, or so it's argued. And for that, we need huge amounts of oil, and without it, the military can't function. So oil has been viewed by American leaders as a national security matter, not just an economic or an energy matter, but a national security matter. And when you securitize things that way, when you declare them a matter of national security, that means you're prepared to use military force to protect them. And indeed, American leaders, going back several decades now, have used force to protect oil.
Mm. I think that's an important thing, I think, for people to understand about petroleum, and that is that perhaps if you look at the period before World War II and after World War II, there was a big difference in that petroleum has been important for the American economy probably for maybe close to 100 years, maybe not quite that much, but that before World War II, this was largely a matter of domestic policy because we could pump out of the ground in the United States the oil that we needed. But after World War II, that really changed. We could not supply our own needs. We started to become more and more dependent on oil from outside the United States. And so at that point, you make this transition between oil and energy being simply a domestic matter, a matter for domestic policy, to something that is a foreign policy issue.
That's right, David. And the turning point was in World War II when President Roosevelt, who was very concerned with this issue, personally involved in the oil issue, worried that in the years after the war, that the United States had supplied so much oil during the war to itself, its own forces, and its allies, that we were rapidly using up our own domestic supply of oil, and that we would become dependent in the future on foreign oil. And this troubled him very much, because he saw it as a strategic vulnerability. And he made it his personal task to try to get a secure source of foreign oil. And he, of course, chose Saudi Arabia for that purpose and laid the groundwork for the American alliance with Saudi Arabia, with the Saudi royal family in particular, that has dominated American policy in the Middle East ever since.
And I think there, again, that's a very important thing for people to understand. I'm sure you would say that was an important thing for people to understand, particularly those people who have concerns about the way that our interest in oil has shaped our policy in the Middle East within the last 10 or 20 years. There are people who argue that that's a primary moving force behind our involvement in Iraq, and there were people who made that argument about the Gulf War that the first President Bush was involved in. But you make the point that every president going back to Franklin Roosevelt, for them, access to petroleum was an important issue, and that it doesn't matter what president we're talking about, and it doesn't matter whether they were a Republican or a Democrat, that this is not just our recent involvement in the Middle East. Yeah, that has a connection with oil, but it didn't just start then. It goes all the way back, at least as back as far as FDR.
That's a very good summary of a good part of my book. Yes, absolutely. I was actually surprised by this when I did the research to find how deeply involved prior American presidents, Roosevelt we've already spoken about, but also Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, Jimmy Carter, all of these presidents devoted a lot of attention to the problem of Middle Eastern oil, and each in their own way contributed to the bolstering of U.S. ties with Saudi Arabia and other allies in the region and increasing America's military involvement there. It was President Carter in 1980, who said that oil from the Persian Gulf is a vital interest of the United States that must be protected with force if necessary. And it was he who established the U.S. Central Command, that is the Department of Defense military command responsible for the Persian Gulf area, and has as its primary function the protection of oil from the Middle East.
Maybe I should introduce again our guest. We're talking this morning with Michael Clare. He is the Five College Professor of Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies. He's also director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies. And the five colleges are Amherst, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith, and University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He is also defense correspondent of The Nation, and he is the author of a number of books, including one titled Resource Wars, which explores in a kind of a general way this way of thinking about resources as an engine, driving engine for conflict, and then a new one which looks at one resource specifically, that's oil. That book is titled Blood and Oil, and it's published by Metropolitan Books. And questions here are certainly welcome. I think we got somebody here getting ready to go. Others can call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Savoy, nearby community, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. How you doing?
Good.
You know, I've always wondered about this, too. You know, whenever you go and you look at the investment that it would take to, get your liquid fuel capacity based on coal, it's a mere drop in the bucket compared to what you're spending to protect these areas, you know, these resources over in different parts of the world, or wage war. You can build a 50,000 barrel a day coal gasification and liquefaction plant for about $1 billion. And, you know, for $100 billion, you could build 100 of them. And, you know, I just don't understand the opposition to doing this. And, you know, and that seems to be the obvious policy. You know, that should be the obvious policy. It'd take maybe 10 years to get them built.
Well, I know, Professor Clare, you have thought about that?
I certainly appreciate the thoughts of the caller, and this is something that troubles me deeply as well. I think that we spend a huge amount of money on protecting Persian Gulf oil. I estimated at somewhere between $75 and $100 billion a year, which is plenty enough to make the kind of investment in new energy technologies that we're going to need to free ourselves from petroleum. But we do have to understand is that American oil companies, with the blessing of the American government, and again I repeat this has been a bipartisan policy, have developed very close ties with these foreign governments, especially the Saudi Arabian government, but others as well. And this whole system of collaboration with these governments and the oil companies has become deeply embedded in our energy system. And the Bush-Cheney administration, which studied the problem in 2001 when they first came into office, had the opportunity to shift gears, to move in the direction that your caller made, and they clearly chose not to do that, to rely on the existing system. And it deeply troubles me that they did make that choice when it's so clear I think we'd be better off going in the other direction.
Yeah, you know, whenever you sit down and you run the arithmetic on it, you know, it's obvious, you know, that you want to, just the mere announcement of such a program would send shockwaves through foreign suppliers. And, you know, it might even, you know, just the mere announcement of such a policy might be enough to stimulate them to get their house in order even, you know, and stabilize that situation even further, but have the neighbors do it and not us. Mm-hmm. Well, hey, we'll see you later.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to someone else here. This next listener is in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk more about President Carter's different approaches, like, for example, the relationship between his oil policy with Saudi Arabia, and then he did at one time call for energy independence. But how does that work in with his peace initiatives with Sadat and Begin in the attempt to solve Palestinian-Israeli problems? And then I have another question after that.
Well, this is very interesting. President Jimmy Carter was a very complex person, and I think a very moral person. And he wrestled
very hard, I believe, with these issues. He did seek energy independence, and he did seek peace in the Middle East. But this was still during the Cold War period, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, and this followed the overthrow of the Shah of Iran earlier in the same year. There was a great deal of anxiety about the Soviet or the radical Shiite threat to the safety of American oil, and he is and his advisors went into panic mode, essentially. And I think they concluded that, the U.S. was so dependent on oil from Saudi Arabia that we had to respond in a very muscular military manner. And so he did decide to militarize our Saudi Arabian and Persian Gulf oil policy and to create the Central Command. So he was a complex man, and but he was in at a time when things looked bleak, and I suppose that's what motivated him.
Okay, well, maybe you could talk more about Sadat, but I was kind of dialing up, and so I missed a little bit. You talked about the existing system and going in another direction. I was wondering what that other direction would be. For example, if we were to be more into conservation or alternative energy sources or develop some kind of coal usage that wasn't so polluting, would this really have any effect on, you know, the geopolitical problems that seem to be down the road with a developing China?
Well, absolutely. I think it's very clear to people who study this, energy experts and environmentalists and others, that we are in a fork in the road here in this country. We can try to perpetuate the existing system, which relies on petroleum for 40% of our energy and coal and natural gas for another 50% and a very limited amount of renewable energy. And this, if we proceed in this way, we are bound to get involved in more conflicts overseas. There's no way of escaping that. Or we could choose to establish a new energy system altogether, which relies much more on renewable sources of energy, on new technologies, for example, the sort that the prior caller was mentioning about using coal in an environmentally safe way to produce liquids, to develop hydrogen, and other new technologies. That's going to be very expensive and take a while. So in the meantime, we have to conserve the petroleum that's left and use it very, very prudently.
Wasn't Carter talking about that 25 years ago?
Yes, he was. And what happened is that that followed the energy crisis of 1973-74 that some of the listeners will recall, all those long gas lines in America. And that jacked up oil prices and made it profitable to develop new oil fields in Alaska and in the North Sea and elsewhere. So in the 1980s and 1990s, we were flooded again with petroleum, cheap petroleum, and we abandoned the energy initiatives of the Carter administration. Now we're discovering there aren't any new sources of oil out there to save us this time. There is no more North Sea or North Slope, so far as anyone could tell, and we don't have those programs that were begun in the 1970s, so we're in much worse shape.
What were some of the motivations? Do you think they were all moral, that Carter wanted to solve the Middle East problems or with Palestine and Israel, or do you think he foresaw something coming in terms of, you know, increased militancy?
You know, I have met President Carter on a few occasions since he left office, and he impresses me very much with his commitment to peace, his belief in the possibilities of negotiation and mediation to bring people together. Mm-hmm. And he's very admirable in that way. I think he's our greatest former president in using his life for the cause of world peace. So I admire him greatly. I think he also understood, although he's not alone in this, that the Arab-Israeli conflict is the time bomb, is the explosive fuel for the entire Middle East. So long as the Arab-Israeli conflict rages, it's impossible to solve any of the other problems in the Middle East. And so it's, I think he understood it was crucial to bring peace to that region, and then it would be possible to solve some of the other problems. But until that conflict is solved, and it isn't solved now, the world will simply be perpetually unsafe.
It seems like he's been rather quiet for the last 3 or 4 years, trying not to step on anyone's feet, I guess.
Well, he has been active in Africa and Latin America, Jimmy Carter, doing very good work.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. We're approaching the midpoint of the program here. Again, perhaps for the benefit of anybody who has just tuned in, I'll introduce again our guest, Michael Clare. He's a scholar who studies global security issues. He is Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and also Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies. And those five colleges are Amherst, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith, and University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's also defense correspondent of The Nation, contributing editor of Current History, member of the editorial board of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and has contributed to many different publications. He is the author of a recently published book that explores the subject we're talking about here this morning. It's titled Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Petroleum, and the publisher's Metropolitan Books. I know that in recent years there has been more and more discussion about the issue of world petroleum reserves, how much there is still in the ground, and that there are some people who say, make the argument that we are either at the peak or we might possibly have even passed the peak, and now we're going to be on the downhill slope. And other people, when they hear that, they say, well, the fact is that there still is recoverable oil and that the development in the technology means that it's possible for us to go and get oil that either we just couldn't before, or perhaps it wouldn't be economically feasible before. And so this talk about our running out of oil anytime soon, it's not the case. And I guess I wonder, are you persuaded by that argument that to some extent that technology is going to bail us out here?
Well, nobody doubts that peak oil is not going to come because petroleum, and now we start with, we have to say we're talking about conventional petroleum. That's the liquid stuff that when you drill into the earth, it comes gushing out, and it's a liquid, and you could readily convert it into gasoline and other usable products. So that's a finite material. The earth only has so much of it, and we're beginning to approach the halfway point of its total exploitation. Now, exactly when that halfway point or peak point will come is a matter of debate. Some people, as you say, David, think that we're at that point now. Others say that there's more oil out there to be discovered, maybe under the Arctic ice cap, maybe far off the coast of North America, that we may find new supplies, and the peak will be put off. But nobody questions that it isn't coming. So the question is, how much time do we have before that arrives, and to what degree we can rely on unconventional sources of petroleum, like the tar sands of Canada and the very heavy oil, the stuff you can't, it's not a liquid that you find in Venezuela. Those materials are plentiful. They can be converted into liquids, but that's much more expensive. And there are very harsh environmental consequences of converting those materials. So we're entering a period where there'll be a lot of debate and stress around these issues. I think it would would be unwise to say that we're about to see the decline in oil. That may not happen for another decade or so. But it would be equally unwise to say there's plentiful petroleum in the world and we don't have to worry about this problem and we could go on driving our cars without any concern for the future. That's equally unwise.
We're getting some other callers here, and we'll get to them. But I also would like to ask you specifically about recent policy in the Middle East and most specifically about the Iraq war. And I think that if you engage people in conversation about, you know, ask them, well, what do you think this war is about? There are some fair amount of people, I'm sure, that will say, well, I think this war is about oil. And there are some people who would say that's the only thing that it's about. The administration, people who speak for it, have said, no, this is not about oil. This is about promotion of democracy and other sorts of things. And then I suppose there are some people who would make this argument that could say. Well, in fact, oil and American energy policy, access to petroleum, is part of the mix of the reasons we went to war in Iraq, but it's not the number one thing, and it may not even be the most important thing in the minds of the people at the administration. Now, having said all that, I guess the question I'm going for is, well, what do you think was the significance of oil in the decision to go to war in Iraq?
Very good question, and I get asked this a lot too. And I always begin my answer by saying that oil has many dimensions. It's a source of energy, it's a source of immense wealth, and it's also a source of great power. Because the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, houses two-thirds of the world's known oil supply, whoever controls that area has their hand on the lifeblood of the world. And it's this power dimension of oil, I think, that has preoccupied the Bush administration, but also prior administrations as well, going back to Jimmy Carter. And it has been consistently American policy since Carter's day, that no other country other than the United States can be allowed to control or threaten this immense source of economic and political power, that America must be the dominant country in the region. Now, if you accept that notion, which American presidents have been very clear about, then the decision to go to war with Iraq was wholly consistent with that. And I think in the minds of President Bush, and especially Vice President Dick Cheney, who explicitly made this argument, this was a war to protect America's vital interests in the Persian Gulf. And that does not rule out what the administration says, but at the same time, when you put it that way, America's vital interests in the Persian Gulf include oil at the base. So all of these actually come together, I think, in explaining the war in Iraq.
Let's go back to the phones here. We'll go to caller in Champaign, I believe, line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought there were two people ahead of me. Just on that issue, I'm looking at an old AP story. Judicial Watch, not a left-wing group, joined the various bodies that were trying to sue to find the Cheney's oil task force documents.
That's right.
And they apparently got something from the Commerce Department that was worked up, and it looks like it was worked up to go into that discussion, which we've never been privy to, that actually had, you know, maps of pipelines, and there's one that's titled Foreign Suitors of Iraqi Oil Field Contracts. And it's pretty clear, it seems to me, that this was, you know, on the docket. They were talking about it, and it's one of the reasons why this administration is so secretive.
Well, I think that you're onto something here. If you look at the Cheney Commission's final report, known as the National Energy Policy Report of May 17, 2001, also called the Cheney Report, when you look at that closely, you find that they concluded that for America to continue its reliance on petroleum as its major source of energy, we would have to import twice as much oil in the next 20 years as we do now. And that's a huge amount of additional oil that would have to come to this country to preserve our oil way of life. And they further concluded that half of that oil was going to have to come from the Persian Gulf because there isn't enough anywhere else to provide that oil. Half of all the additional oil coming to the world markets would have to come from the Persian Gulf. And they further concluded that all of those countries, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, would have to double or triple their production. So I think they were looking very closely at Iraq, which has the world's second largest reserves after Saudi Arabia, as the site for much greater supply of oil to this country and to world markets. They projected that Iraq could be producing three times as much oil as it is now. But there was an obstacle in the way. Saddam Hussein, who was under sanctions, who was not capable of increasing production. And I think they concluded in their hearts that Saddam Hussein would have to be removed as an obstacle to boosting Iraqi production.
Well, I would put it a little differently. I would say that any indigenous, you know, nationalist organization, even not a creep like Hussein, who the U.S. had backed when he was useful, but any nationalist group, no matter what stripe, would not really be what the U.S. would want if it wants to continue to use oil at the rate that it and manner it's using.
So well, here we have to distinguish between the United States and the Bush-Cheney plan, because the United States could make the decision, we as the people of the United States could decide to reduce our petroleum dependency, and then we wouldn't be caught in this bind. But this administration has made the decision to increase our dependence on imported oil, and to do that means pushing out of the way, as you say, leaders of whatever political stripe, left, right, or otherwise, who stand in the way of increased production. And it's what's led us into a clash, a confrontation with Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, who also is reluctant to allow American companies to come in and boost Venezuela's production. And there has been friction between Washington and Caracas over this.
Yeah, OPEC is meeting as we speak, and you didn't hear the top of the headline news, but the currently the lead of the day for the Bush administration, he was ranting about how we're going to get more of our oil indigenously, which isn't realistic because we'd have to boil the oil shale in Montana or something to actually do that and turn the whole state upside down. Thank you.
All right. Given, Professor Clair, given the fact that in the recent presidential election, perhaps the major issue or one of the major issues was the war, does it surprise you that there was almost, at least that I can recall, almost no discussion of the issue of energy?
I was surprised by that. I have to say, I thought there would be more discussion of oil in the campaign, and I was a little surprised that didn't occur. I think people understood that some of the issues that were discussed, the war in Iraq, the state of the American economy, the environment, that these relate back to the oil problem. And I certainly do think that as we come into the next, when the administration comes back for its second term, oil is going to rise again to the top of the agenda. President Bush plans to reintroduce the energy bill that has not passed in Congress these past years because of concern over drilling in Anwar. I think we're going to see continued high oil prices. I think we're going to see environmental issues gaining traction and visibility. So I do think that oil will come back at us as a major policy issue. Just for example, we're going to have a landmark Supreme Court case coming down the pike that I think will have tremendous impact on our society. The state of California has adopted legislation mandating that all cars sold in California beginning in 10 years from now have 30% less emissions of carbon dioxide, which is the main gas responsible for global warming. And the automobile companies are saying that this is not state policy, it has to be federal policy. And I think the outcome of that decision will be very, very closely watched because it will bear on our oil behavior in a very substantial way.
We have other callers. Let's go on to someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, actually, you'd mentioned, for the money that we pay at the pumps for gas is really not the true price. If we factor in, you were talking about $100 billion that we're spending in terms of protecting this interest, has anyone really calculated out what it actually, what the true price, because it's unrealistically low?
Well, you're quite right about that. It's difficult to do this in a very precise scientific way because a lot of the costs of protecting Middle Eastern oil are hidden from us. They're a share of the budget for things like military training and buying equipment that's spread across all of the military forces. So you have to use a rough estimate. And my calculation is that about a fourth of the defense budget
is devoted to the Middle East and otherwise to the protection of oil, and that comes out to about $100 billion a year. And if you divide that up on the cost of gasoline, it'll, and this is a very rough figure, it probably would add something like a dollar to the cost a gallon of what we pay for our gasoline. So we're paying for that. We're paying that extra tax, but we do it through our income tax, not as a sales tax at the pump.
Yeah, and the other point is this is where the auto industry has historically had a lot of pressure in terms of keeping that price down.
Well, absolutely, and you know, and Americans are very troubled about the high price of gasoline at where it is already. To add a dollar to that to pay for the war would have a devastating effect for many people, but they just don't realize they're paying for it anyway through other means.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go to line number 3. This is also an Urbana listener. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd read that there might be as much as 200 billion barrels of oil in Central Asia, and I was wondering if in your book you address the situation in Central Asia and the Trans-Caucasus and how that might impact future oil wars and, you know, especially maybe competition with China.
Thank you. I do discuss that at length in my book, Blood and Oil. The fact is that the 200 billion barrel projection for what might be found in Central Asia, now 200 billion barrels would be equivalent to what Iraq is believed to possess. So that's a very large amount of oil. But those projections were made in the 1990s before any drilling commenced in the region. Now there's been a lot of drilling, and most oil experts have become much more pessimistic about the amount of oil in the Caspian Sea region in Central Asia. There's a lot of natural gas. They're finding a lot of natural gas, and that has energy and economic consequences we could talk about because Russia and China want their hands on that natural gas. But it doesn't do us as much good in terms of petroleum. So there's a little bit of pessimism there about the future of Caspian oil. Nonetheless, the Bush administration, like the Clinton administration before that, is very eager to get at least some of that oil coming to the United States. We're very deeply involved in the new pipeline being built from the Caspian Sea at Baku through Georgia to Turkey, the BTC pipeline it's called, and there are American troops in Georgia whose job it is to help the Georgian military protect the pipeline now under construction against sabotage or attack. And I think this is going to be a site of conflict for a long time to come. Russia has troops in Georgia as well. And so you have a case where there are American and Russian troops in the same neighborhood, both with an interest in controlling the flow of oil. So in my mind, this is a very volatile situation.
How does China fit in? Do you think they might be interested in some kind of pipeline projects in the other direction?
They are more than somewhat interested. President Hu Jintao, on his first foreign trip after being made president a year or so ago, traveled to Kazakhstan to seal the deal with the Kazakh government to build a natural gas pipeline and an oil pipeline from Kazakhstan through China. Now, this is going to be a $10 to $20 billion proposition, so some people are dubious that it'll ever move forward. But there's absolutely no doubt that China is very interested in this region, and not just in terms of energy, but also in strategic terms. China has established something called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a little bit like a watered-down CETO or CENTO or NATO, which it's using as an umbrella to develop military ties with Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. So it's getting involved militarily in the same area where Russia is involved militarily, and the United States now has military bases. I don't think there's anywhere else in the world where you could find Russian and American and Chinese military advisors all vying for influence in the same region.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Michael Clare. He is one of the world's leading authorities on the causes and consequences of war and U.S. military policy, and has authored a number of books on the changing nature of warfare, including one titled Resource Wars, that makes this argument that we've discussed, that more and more conflict around the world is over control and access to natural resources. And his most recent is Blood and Oil, which looks specifically at petroleum. The subtitle is The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Petroleum. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Michael Clare is Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies. He's based at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, which is one of the five colleges. Other questions are welcome. We have several people. We'll try to get them all in. Next, we'll go to a caller in Belgium, Illinois, nearby, line number four. Hello.
Good morning. A couple of topics I'd like to bring into the conversation. One, you keep saying that this started essentially with the Carter administration, but really didn't it start quite a bit longer with the Aramco and the British and the French dividing up the Middle East into the problem areas we have today?
Yes, actually, you're quite right, and I did talk earlier in the show about the role of Franklin Roosevelt, who was the first American president to take an interest in the area. He personally met with King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, the founder of the modern Saudi dynasty. They met in 1945, and he's the one who established the close U.S. relationship with the Saudi royal family. But at that time, Britain, Great Britain, was the dominant military power in the region because of its long history of colonialism in the Middle East. And so the United States deferred to Great Britain to act as the regional hegemon, the protective power. It was when the British finally pulled out of the area in the mid-1970s that the United States became more deeply involved. And essentially what President Carter said in 1980, in other words, was that we have to take over the job of regional hegemon that was once performed by, or the regional police state that was once performed by the British. So you're quite right about this.
The other aspect is, here in the Midwest, we produce a lot of corn. And right now, at the price of corn now and the price of gas, we're getting very close to being able to produce enough fuel price-wise to be able to be quite economically viable. Obviously, we don't have enough corn to feed cars, animals, and people, so we're going to have to make a little decision there. But wouldn't rapidly this kind of renewable resource be very viable?
This is an area where I see great promise if we can improve our technology for converting not just the food parts of corn plants and other plants, which are needed for other purposes, but the waste material from plant crops. And there are experiments underway to find ways to use this biomass to produce ethanol as a fuel. So we have to invest in these techniques to try to make that breakthrough. But if we rely on the corn itself, there simply isn't enough corn in the world to both provide the food that the world needs and to supplement petroleum on a very large scale. And I think feeding people has to be the first priority. But corn can be used as a supplement in some cases when supplies of petroleum are scarce. But I think the priority has to be to find ways to use waste materials.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Champaign next. So line two. Hello.
Morning, David.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading the reviews on Amazon of your author's book here, and he's got batting 100% here. He's getting a 5-star rating on his book. Anyway, the last caller kind of stole my thunder. I don't know if your guest is a fan of Willie Nelson, but Willie Nelson has been running his tour bus for the last few years on biodiesel. Basically, you know, using fast food, recycled oil, B100 biodiesel, you know, from corn. And he says any diesel engine can run basically totally unmodified on biodiesel.
I'm not enough of an expert on the exact mechanics of that. I do know that there are many initiatives like this underway around the United States, usually at the local level because the big oil companies are not interested.
Exactly. You know, I mean, even out in Hawaii, on Maui, there's a place called Pacific Biodiesel, and many of the car rental places have the Volkswagen diesels that are getting 40 to 50 miles a gallon, and they're all running them on biodiesel.
So, well, this is very promising, and I think out of these experiments and local initiatives might come the breakthrough, or one of the breakthroughs that we're going to rely on in the future. I argue that we should be spending a lot more money on these experiments to see if they offer great promise. I think just at this stage in the game, it's not clear that these methods could produce enough fuel on a very large scale to replace our heavy dependence on petroleum. I mean, we use 20 million barrels of petroleum a day in this country. That's just a mammoth amount every day, 365 days a year. And replacing that with these other methods is going to take a great deal of investment and initiative and research, and we're not there yet. That's why I argue we should be spending less money on military forces and more money on energy development and research.
My last question is, are you familiar with the book Crossing the Rubicon?
Yes, this is another look at the consequences of peak oil, the possibility that as the supply of petroleum begins to dry up, that people will become more desperate and there'll be more conflict as a result. I worry about this myself.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to caller line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested. I tuned in late, but I'm interested in bringing up the notion of nuclear energy and how it can partially replace our needs for fossil fuels. You haven't seemed to discuss this at all. Many people are convinced that this is the way that the industrialized world will have to go.
Okay, thank you. I hear a lot of discussion about this. Now, let me divide this question in two parts. One part is that petroleum is largely used in this country for transportation, to power individual cars, trucks, buses, and vans, and airplanes, also trucks and ships, trains and ships. So at this point, nuclear power is not a solution for our dependence on vehicular transportation.
Well, not exactly true, because people are talking about the hydrogen economy and the fact that nuclear power can help in this aspect.
Well, I was going to come to that. Thank you for bringing it up. I also am an advocate of high-speed rail, that we should have a network the way Europe does, where you could crisscross the country at a third of the time by train than we do now with our 19th century railroad technology. And that can be powered by electricity. So there is a way to harness nuclear power. But the other side of the coin that scientists still worry about is what to do with the waste products. There is research being done on this, but at this point, most local communities are afraid to give a permit for new nuclear power plants because of their fear that the radioactive wastes will accumulate in their own neighborhood because we don't as yet have a safe way of disposing of them.
Yes, that's true, but there are developments actually in the nuclear energy field which use so-called fast neutron reactors, in which the claim is made, and I'm not an expert in it, that in fact the nuclear waste would be much, much reduced, and also the proliferation problem would be much, much reduced.
Yes, this exceeds my scientific expertise. I know that there's a debate about it. I sit in with nuclear scientists who make that argument and also contest it. So I'm in favor of providing additional research funds to this scientific community to to test these ideas further. That I think we have to do. But I don't think we should make a decision about implementing it without this further research.
Check.
All right. Thank you for the call. We're at the point pretty much, Professor Clare, that we have to stop, and I'm sorry we have some other calls we can't take. Can you, in a minute, can you give me your worst-case scenario if we do nothing?
Well, if we do nothing, we will be in a situation 20 years from now, in 2025, when we have to import 20 million barrels a day of petroleum to keep our energy system going. Most of this is going to have to come from areas that are unstable or hostile to the United States or beset by internal wars. And if we go on militarizing our foreign policy, then Iraq will be just the beginning of a series of wars over oil. And I just think that this is unconscionable and we have to turn away from it.
Well, for people who are interested in reading more on the subject, you can look for the book that we've mentioned, Blood and Oil, by our guest, Michael Clare. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Michael Clare is based at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He's a five-college professor of peace and world security studies. Joint appointment at Amherst, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith, and University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Those are the five. He is also a defense correspondent of The Nation and a contributing editor to Current History. And Professor Clare, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me on.